Unit 1. Being British. Culture Then and Now. A medieval proverb offered, "Tell me where you're from, and I'll tell you who you are." In the 21st century, does that proverb still ring true? Being English used to be so easy, journalist Jeremy Paxman argues in his 1998 study, The English, A Portrait of a People. They were one of the most easily identified peoples on the earth, recognised by their language, their manners, their clothes, and the fact that they drank tea by the bucket load. It is all so much more complicated now. Being British, of which being English is but one component, is an even more complex proposition that this textbook will attempt to explore. It is certainly impossible these days to recognise a Brit by outward appearance. But what about behaviour or attitude? Perhaps some shades of those older ways of acting and thinking remain, but new ones have arisen. In what ways is a British culture identifiable and meaningful in this new century? Is it the same, similar, or wildly different from traditional British culture of yore? This textbook will seek to examine those issues too. It seems obvious that both older stereotypical and newer living elements combine to produce our total image of a people's culture. Culture is not a natural concept. It is learned. It stems from inherited ideas, repeated patterns of human behaviour influenced by time, and, perhaps above all, it is a function of place, of where we live and who else lives there with us. Culture is made by people embroidering socially agreed shapes onto natural phenomena, packaging and patterning our animal instincts into repeatable modes of behaviour to suit a time and place. For example, what we choose to eat for breakfast, how we regard and behave towards others, what music we make, what clothes we choose to wear. Culture cannot be a stable, fixed concept. It is a fluid notion, developing and changing over time. Identity, personal or national, is the same. There is no national culture or identity more fluid than that of Britain and the British. The British Islands are home to a people with ideas and attitudes different to those they held a century ago. Old stereotypes and certainties are no more. Perhaps this is true of many, if not all, countries. In Britain's case, though the new country and the old seem superficially different, deep connections exist. Cause and effect are discernible, and today's Britain and its people are logical and natural descendants of the nation's ancient culture and settlers. Much new British culture can be directly traced back along historical lines and is explicable in terms of deep-rooted attitudes and a mindset that have stayed fairly constant as the world outside has altered. Given the dimensions and proclivities of the traditional, stereotypical British character, combined with sociological and historical developments that have reshaped the islands from without and within, Britain could not have become anything but the kind of place it is today. The seeming disparity between ancient and modern Britain is in fact understandable if sensitively analysed. Yet this disparity itself is overlooked or ignored by many textbooks about and guides to British culture. These books that describe unchanging Britain most usually prefer to concentrate on traditional aspects of British life and culture, some of which have, as we shall see, become outdated clichés and redundant stereotypes more suited to a museum or period novel than a purportedly up-to-date survey of British culture. Such books are wide of the mark, almost works of fiction nowadays. This textbook will hopefully present a more realistic and balanced overview of Britain as it is now and as it was before, and demonstrate that apparent contradictions between the old and the new are, in fact, usefully and instructively explicable in terms of a deeper intangible Britishness that lies behind the logical development and necessary adaptation of attitudes and culture over time. The visible shift from tea-drinking gentleman to beer-guzzling hooligan, from angelic housewife to feminist spice girl, from a peace-loving nation of shopkeepers and village bobbies to a noisy urban jungle of crack estates and drugs-related drive-by shootings, does not mean that 21st-century Britain has lost all links with its former self, the Britain of yore. Quite the opposite. Modern-day culture and beliefs have been specifically formed in the light and under the influence of the very older ingrained values and attitudes of which most conservative textbooks dissemblingly speak. This book will show why and how this has come to pass. The old and the new are both parts of the same whole, the whole that is British culture. Unit 2. Is this the United Kingdom? The naming of parts. Is it the United Kingdom, Great Britain, or just Britain? How about the British Isles? Are the citizens British or English or both? The first problem with talking about the place is what to call it. "I thought it was the UK," laments disillusioned punk rocker Johnny Rotten in the 1976 Sex Pistols song Anarchy in the UK, a vicious attack on the once proud nation's modern lack of identity. So, is it the UK? This basic confusion over something so presumably simple as the nation's name is, as we shall see throughout this book, quite revealing. Often assumed to be fixed and unchanging, British identity is in fact fluid and eclectic, and, to an extent, always has been since the hitherto separate parliaments of England, Wales and Scotland were united in 1707. Ireland became British in 1801, but in 1922 the independent Republic of Ireland was formed in the south. Northern Ireland, not entirely contentedly, remains part of the United Kingdom today. The United Kingdom is, then, a political term for the union of four countries. Great Britain is the name of the island containing three of those countries, but does not include Northern Ireland. The British Isles is another geographical term for all the islands off continental Europe's northwest coast, including the whole of Ireland. However, Britain has been a multicultural nation for a very long time. 2,000 years ago, the British Isles were monocultural. Celts, who had originally migrated there from mainland Europe, were the sole inhabitants. But during the next millennium, the islands were repeatedly infiltrated by external cultures. In 43 AD, Romans invaded. They christened the country Britannia, from which the term Britain developed. In the 5th century, Angles and Saxons arrived from Germany, Holland and Denmark to add to the cultural mix, and the term England, Angleland, was born. After 800, the influx of warring Vikings from Norway and Denmark further complicated the equation, and in 1066, the date every British schoolchild knows, the Normans invaded from France and conquered the nation. For the next 200 years, French was spoken as well as English in Britain, and the original Celts were forced to withdraw into what is now Wales and Scotland. The indigenous culture became marginal. It is no simpler nowadays. Whatever singular British identity, cultural and geographical, there might arguably have been at the start of the 20th century, has been challenged and eroded into ambiguity by events of the latter part of that period. The Welsh and the Scots have to some extent officially reclaimed their birthright claim to independence. in 1998, an independent National Assembly for Wales was formed, and in 1999, an independent Scottish Parliament established. Britain had already joined the European Community in 1973, symbolically surrendering its geographical and political independence from the larger European continent. Nominally relinquishing a unique identity in favour of becoming one of several types of European culture, it is significant that Britain remains still, in many European minds, the least cooperative and most stubbornly independent of all the members of the European group. Britain's defiant unwillingness to adopt the single European currency is seen as symbolic of its desire still to retain its own identity and not wholly sacrifice its singular culture to a larger one. Denmark was the only other European Union country that did not join the scheme when it began. With so many types of input, it is little wonder that the matter of British identity can sometimes be less than crystal clear. As we shall see in subsequent units of this book, so many seemingly stable elements of British culture, education, religion, the monarchy, and arguably the national character, contain and are complicated by contradictions that may result from the eclectic manner in which the country was gradually formed. A contemporary musician, Stephen Patrick Morrissey, has argued in song that members of his generation are the last truly British people you will ever know, as Britain embraces more and more elements of formerly other cultures, becoming itself a nation of variety and multiple identities. "We are now coming to the end of the British story," echoes the socialist writer Stephen Hassler, "under the twin forces of globalisation and the dynamic of European unity." Exceptions abound, and it is often misleading to generalise about the culture of a nation so influenced and shaped by forces from outside its geographical borders. In the elusivity may lie the charm and appeal. How Britain's nevertheless attempt to present a unified front may tell us a lot about the British personality lying deeper than the outside. Unit 3. Living Symbols. The British Royals. Born in 1926, Queen Elizabeth II is Britain's oldest monarch ever. Ruler of Britain since 1952, she retains ultimate authority over the government of the United Kingdom and the armed forces, and is official head of the British legal system and the Church of England. Yet the monarch's power is as symbolic as actual. Britain is the only nation in the world not legally obliged to print the country's name on its stamps. Instead, Elizabeth's face looks out regally from postage stamps and all British banknotes and coins, instantly recognisable worldwide, an icon of Britishness. For what could be more quintessentially British than the royal family? In fact, quite a few things could be. Elizabeth's great-grandparents were German. The royal family changed their surname from Saxe-Coburg-Gotha during World War I when anti-German sentiment was strong. King George V, the present Queen's grandfather, renounced German titles belonging to him and adopted the name of his castle, Windsor. The Queen's husband, Prince Philip, who was born Philippus Schleswig-Holstein-Sonderburg-Glücksburg, is a native Greek who only became a British subject at the age of 26. He took the British surname Mountbatten, an anglicised version of his mother's maiden name, Battenberg. Does that mean the royal family is not so British then? That does not matter to Britons. The royal family remains, for most, a respected and deeply British institution, and the Queen herself is still regarded as a true symbol of all that was and is good about Britain, namely reserve, the upholding of tradition, and, most of all, quiet but unshakable dignity in difficult times. Of course, that dignity has been tested. In 1997, the divorce, affairs, and subsequent death in a car crash of Diana Spencer, first wife of the Queen's eldest son Charles, proved an ordeal for the royals in many ways. The Windsors' initial refusal to make public statements regarding the former princess's demise, or grant her a royal funeral, was viewed not as reserve proper to a royal household, but as inappropriate coldness and insensitivity by the media and public. When the Queen relented and, eventually, expressed genuine sympathy in a televised speech, she won back many supporters by the unveiling of a hitherto unseen human face. Members of the royal family are, of course, human. Scandals and reports of behaviour improper to persons of their status have never been scarce. George IV and Edward VII were both notoriously involved in drinking, gambling and adultery. However, Diana Spencer was, the public decided, more human than most. The People's Princess, as Tony Blair christened her, captured the love of the British long before her death. Her openness in interview and humane charity work brought her ordinary people's love. Diana's was the image that modernised the British royal family. In her final years, no longer a princess but still hounded by the paparazzi and behaving emotionally in public, Diana earned not castigation but further respect from the British people. She was seen symbolically in Elton John's memorial song as a candle in the wind, a lost little girl who had become involved with a family whose values and codes of conduct did not match her own, and who had destroyed the purity of this English rose. Of course, most of Diana Spencer's story is filtered through the media, newspapers, television, and movies. Ironically, the same media that had persecuted Diana in her final days did much to resurrect sympathy for the royal family that they had accused of shunning her. The 2004 film, The Queen, dramatised events surrounding Diana's death from the royal family's point of view. It showed the royals as ordinary, vulnerable, and confused by the contradiction they embody in modern times. Immovable, emotionless symbols of decency and stoicism, but also real human role models for a British public now aware of the big picture, right down to what the Queen watches on television, eats for breakfast, wears in bed. Interpreted positively or negatively by different persons, but undeniably important, like all archetypal symbols, the Queen and the royal family remain meaningful for all that they potentially signify rather than for minute internal workings. We want the timeless and lovely rose, regardless of how soon it withers or how ugly the insects living on it and in it are. We treasure and wish to preserve the symbol even if the real thing disappoints us sometimes. Flawed and occasionally under siege, but still marvelled at, the Windsors are such a symbol, still standing for dignity in the face of crisis. Unit 4. Dumbing It Down. British Education. Education for all British children became compulsory in 1888. In 2008, children are required by law to receive education from the age of 5 to 16. Notably, though education is compulsory, British children are not legally required to attend school. This reflects the British preference for holistic liberal educating, from Latin meaning leading out, drawing out latent talents of a learner and encouraging independent, original thought, rather than formalised teaching, from Germanic meaning telling or showing. British education ideally makes no distinction between scientific and artistic subjects. Medicine and poetry are both regarded as equally important and worthy of study, equally true. Education is not the piling on of learning, information, data, facts, skills or abilities. That's training or instruction, wrote the 16th century humanist Sir Thomas More. Charles Dickens satirised the utilitarian approach in his 1854 novel Hard Times, in which a Victorian teacher strictly encourages mechanical memorisation of provable facts and empirical data. "Now, what I want is facts. Teach these boys and girls nothing but facts. Facts alone are wanted in life." On the contrary, proper education, as More argued, is making visible what is hidden as a seed. Respect for this progressive attitude and mistrust of homogeneous schooling designed around facts and testing remains in Britain today. Balanced and appropriate education must never neglect encouragement of individualism and original thought. Nurturing children as individuals and allowing them freedom to express their own identity is at the heart of British education, rather than having teachers bombard passive learners with talk and chalk classroom drills with correct and incorrect responses. Thus, there was concern in 1988 when the then Conservative government overhauled the United Kingdom's educational system by introducing a national curriculum of set subjects and learning targets, standardising lesson content and exams. The national curriculum seems totally at odds with the traditional liberal conception of British education. It makes 80% of secondary school lessons compulsory core subjects and places maximum emphasis on the practical aspects of education and is, unsurprisingly, opposed by many teachers and parents. A perhaps predictable side effect of the national curriculum has been the dumbing down of British education. A British Broadcasting Corporation study claims that standardisation has led to easier, shallower and less demanding classes and examinations and caused a sharp decline in standards since 1988. Course content in all subjects is broader but shallower, with a simpler, less demanding syllabus and easier exams in which calculators and crib sheets, lists of formulae and explanatory notes are allowed. School tests have been dumbed down to ensure that pupils get the right answer quickly, rather than working through ideas, laments Jonathan Milton, headmaster of a London school. The United Kingdom government has been accused of dumbing down universities as well, because of recently announced plans to widen and make more lax the criteria used to decide what can be called a university. University faculty members fear that university degrees and university education itself could thus be devalued, claiming that this announcement makes a mockery of the very concept of a university. However, the plans figured prominently in new government proposals for higher education revealed by Prime Minister Gordon Brown in January 2008. Sadly, at all levels, dumbing down seems to be the order of the day. Harry Potter novels are now studied by secondary school English students, and in some schools, the original texts of Shakespeare's plays have been abandoned as too difficult, replaced by simplified manga versions. Even more scandalously, it was revealed in 2007 that pupils could score more than 55% in a National Secondary Education Completion Test on Shakespeare without reading any of his works, so general and vague were the examination questions. More and more observers believe that youngsters increasingly lack patience and are losing the art of concentrating for long periods. This might be because they have been brought up to expect instant gratification in Britain's contemporary quick-fix culture. Fast food, fast service, fast downloading, and now fast education. The dumbing down of the curriculum and simplification of examinations makes it impossible to fail, and can give even good students an inflated sense of their abilities and maturity, and remove the desire for self-improvement and self-discovery that should be prime motivators for any young person. With many young Britons already confused about their identity and future, such developments may be adding to their sense of confusion in a world changing not for the better. Unit 5. The Jokes on God. Changing Modes of British Faith. Referring to the Christian practice of bathing a baby's head at church baptism, a popular British joke runs, "I've stopped going to church. The last time I was there, the vicar threw water in my face." A joke, perhaps, but baptisms, weddings and funerals are the only occasions upon which the average British citizen now sets foot inside a church. 59% of British adults never or practically never go to church. Yet 3 out of 4 British people still claim to be Christian. Religion, both the organised public and the personal private version, is one of the most fundamental and enduring manifestations of a society's micro and macro cultures over time. Complex and contradictory British attitudes concerning religion today reveal much concerning British attitudes concerning themselves. This is because the British want to have their cake and eat it too. They want it both ways, claiming to be believers when it suits them, denying religious conviction when asked to be specific. According to the 2001 National Census, less than half of British people believe in a God, yet 72% declared themselves Christian. 66% of the population, about 33 million people, claim to have no actual connection to any religion or church, despite what they say in public or write down on official forms. Whatever Brits are, they are backpedalling when it comes to public displays of faith. Between 1979 and 2005, half of all self-professed Christians stopped going to church on Sunday. Church attendance in particular, and religious belief in general in the United Kingdom, have suffered immense decline since the 1950s. And all signs indicate a continued secularisation of British society in the future. Not surprisingly then, according to a worldwide survey conducted in 2003, less than 17% of Britons say that religion is a significant factor in their life, and less than a third of the British public regard religion as important. Personal experience, family, education and friends were all placed higher in ranking. Interestingly, in the United States, over 60% of people think that religion is important in their life, making it the only developed country that considers itself generally religious. Cynics would say that the United States' lack of history makes it a country with a special need for faith in something outside itself. Are you confused? Maybe the British are confused about religion too, or simply hedging their bets when it comes to faith. Christianity arrived in Britain from Rome in the 1st or 2nd century, and since King Henry VIII anglicanized Christianity in 1534, outlawing the Roman Catholicism that would not permit him a divorce, the Church of England, a mixture of Catholic and Protestant beliefs, has been the official religion in England, and outsiders may thus hold a preconceived notion of Britain as a largely Christian region. Yet with over 170 distinct religions counted in the 2001 census, including Muslim, Hindu, Sikh, Jewish, Buddhist and atheist, the current religious makeup of the United Kingdom is certainly diverse, complex, multicultural and surprising. Perhaps the most shocking indication of the irreverent attitude towards matters of faith held by many modern Britons is the inclusion in the nation's top 6 religions as measured in the census of the Jedi Knight religion, named after the fictitious characters in the Star Wars movies. Shortly before the census was taken, an anonymous spam email was widely circulated in the United Kingdom, stating that if 10,000 people put Jedi on the census form, it might become a fully recognised and legal religion. The email asked recipients to become Jedi Knights, just to annoy people, and was typical of the defensive, British ironic and light-hearted treatment of potentially grave matters. But so many persons chose to declare themselves as Jedi disciples that it made the official list, following Church of England, Roman Catholic, Muslim, Buddhist and Hindu. The Jedi incident demonstrates the lack of solemnity with which some United Kingdom subjects now contemplate matters of faith once taken most seriously. During Henry VIII's reign, one's choice of religion could be a matter of life or death, with public dissenters from the official belief sentenced to death. Nowadays, it has become a matter that allows practical jokers to poke fun at the notion of religion. As we will see, humour is the preferred method of self-defence for Brits, a compensatory way of dealing with anxiety and lack of confidence. In matters of faith, as in other areas, it seems that the new Britain has turned away from, albeit blinkered, stubborn, certainties towards a future that leaves options open for new meaning to be created. Unit 6. Meet the Old Boss. Britain's Political Vision. In his resignation speech on the 10th of May 2007, ex-Prime Minister Tony Blair recalled his leadership. "I looked at my own country. A great country. Wonderful history. Magnificent traditions. Proud of its past, but strangely uncertain of its future. Uncertain about the future. Almost old-fashioned. All of that was curiously symbolised in its politics." Politics is a prime example of culture, a man-made system imposed on life. As such, it truly reflects a nation's changing mindset over time. Technically, a monarch rules Britain, but in practice, the elected governing political party holds overall authority as the government. Laws and decisions are simply rubber-stamped by the Queen, as advised by her government, with the support of both Houses of Parliament. The centre of power in this relationship has shifted over the centuries from the monarch to the House of Lords, which is an upper-class elite with hereditary titles, and then to the House of Commons, to which people are elected by their local community. The government's authority is rarely undermined. It is a typical British contradiction that a seemingly democratic nation with all adult citizens having the right to choose their government by voting normally leads to an elected government's power remaining unchallenged for the duration of its tenure. General elections only need to be held once every 5 years. Superficially flexible and accessible, the British political system is actually rigid and frozen in tradition. The traditional view of British politics makes much of the country's embedded and enduring class system, the three-tier hierarchy of upper class, middle class and working class. Traditionally, the Labour Party was the working class voters' political party of choice, and the Conservatives stood for the upper class, with the Liberal Party somewhere in between, implying more liberal, free, non-conservative thinking, but not solely for the middle class. That system indeed pertained through to the first half of the 20th century, but it has been complicated and subverted now by various factors, including Europeanisation, immigration, the rise up the ranks of the entrepreneur during Thatcher's loads of money conservative epoch, and the similar but ideologically opposed emergence of the grassroots business community whose rise to prominence was encouraged and financially supported by Blair's Labour government. It is more possible now than it ever was in Britain to be upwardly mobile and determine one's own place on the social ladder. less possible than ever before to guess someone's class by his or her accent, job, place of birth, place of residence, or the area in schools in which he or she was brought up. The social class into which one was born is not necessarily the social class in which one will die now. Before we rest on our laurels, we had best soberly note that dissatisfaction with politics and class discrimination still very much exists in the United Kingdom. There are more homeless people in the United Kingdom than ever before, and unemployment is considerable. Major political issues of concern in current British national politics, as of a nationwide poll in September 2006, are race relations and immigration, defence and terrorism, crime, law and order, the National Health Service, education, environmental issues, the economy, housing and house prices, pensions and benefits, and taxation. Since the period leading up to Tony Blair's decision to step down as Prime Minister and party leader to be replaced by Gordon Brown on the 27th of June 2007, the Labour government has been under criticism. There has been public opposition to Britain's participation in the Iraq conflict, as well as disagreements over law and order and young people's behaviour and the country's immigration policies. However, the general consensus is that the issues matter now more than the party in power. The Labour and Conservative parties are no longer seen as opposite poles, but as offering more or less the same general policies with sundry minor differences. Left and right are now nearer to a common centre than they have perhaps ever been. In 1971's Won't Get Fooled Again, a sarcastic attack on the stagnant British political landscape and the interchangeable nature of political leaders, whatever their party, English band The Who sang, "Meet the new boss, same as the old boss." That's very much how many British people feel about politicians and their parties nowadays. Unit 7. You Have to Laugh. British humour. British humour can be incomprehensible to non-Brits, even those whose native language is English. This is not just because its purveyors tend to use a lot of slang. During the last 50 years, absurd humour, pioneered by the Monty Python team in the 1960s and thriving nowadays with avant-garde performers such as Vic Reeves and the surreal Mighty Boosh, have become extremely popular. Even some Brits do not understand some of it. However, it makes people laugh nonetheless. A simple joke made famous by the English comedian Tommy Cooper tells us a lot about what comprises much British humour, absurd or otherwise. "I walked into a bar. I said, 'Ouch! It was an iron bar.'" This gag relies on two things for its effect. Reversal of expectation, for it is not the expected saloon bar, but a metal bar that the speaker encounters, and self-deprecation, which means we laugh at the speaker's misfortune. The first quality involves irony. The second is often said to be a main reason for British humour's failure to translate and remain funny to other cultures. Such gags and irony rely on a pessimistic view of life, and Brits are good at pessimism. In a country where even the sunniest morning can mean rain before lunchtime, optimism is traditionally thin on the ground. The fact that Britannia once ruled the waves, but is now seen by many of its residents as simply a second-rate minor European entity, compounds this sense of potential glory relinquished. Stoicism and the grin-and-bear-it attitude help Brits deal with what otherwise would become grim negativity. "You have to laugh or else you'd cry," a British saying goes. "Laughter is the best medicine," runs another. British people like nothing better than to wallow in self-pity, perhaps finding some sort of solace in the fact that others too are prone to misfortune. The lovable loser syndrome that is at the heart of a lot of British comic acts' appeal. from the hapless Rag and Bone Men, Steptoe and Son, an immensely popular 1970s television series, to the socially inept, eccentric inhabitants of Little Britain, currently one of the United Kingdom's most lauded television comedy shows. The greatest British comic novelist, Charles Dickens, captured this lovable loser type well in many of his novels, and it remains a staple ingredient of British humour today. It is sometimes said, then, that the object of most British humour is the speaker, by extension the British themselves. Conversely, British people reject the humour of other cultures, such as the United States and France, because they feel its object is someone else. British humour is ironic and self-deprecating. Some non-British humour, Brits claim, is arrogant and self-congratulating. A British comedian does not try to tell his audience anything, but merely invites them to laugh at him and with him at his own flaws, whereas much non-British humour, Brits claim, encourages us to ridicule and laugh at people other than ourselves, tells us that we are somehow superior. British humour says, "Look at us, we know nothing, so let's laugh at ourselves, let's enjoy our vulnerability." Much non-British humour says, "Look at them. We know, but they don't. So let's laugh at them." Of course, the above is a gross simplification and overgeneralisation. Some British humour can be cruel as well. Less nowadays than 50 years ago, an insidious strain of racist comedy still exists in British cultures. Stereotypical images of foreigners are mocked and belittled. Now legally outlawed under race relations rulings, television shows such as Till Death Us Do Part, where a loud-mouthed Cockney football fan made foul-mouthed tirades against immigrants to the United Kingdom, and Love Thy Neighbour, where a white British couple was disgusted at living next door to a coloured British couple, were immensely popular during the 1970s when they were aired, but would be banned today. The stand-up comedian Bernard Manning, who became famous in the 1970s and died in 2007, typified the racist comic, with his scathing rants against Pakis, Pakistanis, and Darkies, coloured persons. Manning defended his act by claiming that people have a right to laugh at whatsoever they desire, and, it must be said, remained active and popular with some sectors of British society, though resoundingly unpopular with more, right up till his demise. Humour is a product of its culture, and thus both product of its time and its location. The times change. Therefore, racist comedy finds short shrift nowadays in multiracial Britain. But the place remains. With its disappointing weather and in the shadow of former world dominance, so it is likely that British humour will remain self-deprecating and ironic, pessimistic for at least a few years to come. Unit 8. Singing Rule Britannia. British music. Pop music is an area that clearly maps the passage from traditional, stereotypical to contemporary, eclectic British culture. The world might imagine that for most Brits, pop music means the Beatles, but Brits do not think so anymore. A recent survey of Japanese students asking, "Name something typically British," placed the Liverpool Band, who split up almost 40 years ago, in the top five responses. In a similar survey of Brits, the Beatles were not mentioned by a single respondent. Like most of the nation's cultures, British popular music has moved on since the 1960s. Music is an essential part of British culture, reflecting and clarifying social attitudes by giving them a loud and memorable voice. It always has been, and trends originating in the United Kingdom have often spread to become major movements around the globe. The revolution in open expression of sometimes sexual sentiments that the Beatles, controversial when they first appeared, began has been repeated down the decades by other popular and controversial artists, such as the Sex Pistols, 1970s, Frankie Goes to Hollywood, 1980s, The Smiths and their vocalist Stephen Patrick Morrissey, 1980s to the present, and the currently active Radiohead and Arctic Monkeys. Each of these acts articulated, musically and lyrically, the feelings of young people who bought their records, from the social anarchistic unrest of the punk era, the Pistols' Anarchy in the UK and sarcastic revision of God Save the Queen, anti-homophobic and anti-American anti-war diatribes, the Frankies' Relax and Two Tribes, sadness at the loss of Britishness, the Smiths' The Queen is Dead, and anxiety at the current seemingly passive and unfocused direction of 21st century British society and its youth, Radiohead's dark treatment of the national anthem, and the Monkees' bleak, urban, A Certain Romance. A powerful form of communication, pop music features in the everyday lives of ordinary people and can be an instrument of social influence and change. Lyrics can be personal, political, poetic, and self-expressive with therapeutic effect. Moreover, pop music is an important part of British youth culture as an expression of Britishness. As such, it houses both pride and disillusionment. During the Britpop movement of the 1990s, acts such as Oasis and the Spice Girls paraded the Union Jack in their artwork and sang protectively of their homeland. Other artists have used songs scathingly or poetically to lament the disappearance of true British culture and resultant sense of confusion over personal and national identity. So the Sex Pistols chanted of no future in England's dreaming, and the Chameleons, speaking for Britain's unemployed 3 million desperados, picture Britain's singing Rule Britannia while the walls close in. Let's get out of this country. I have been so unhappy, pleaded the Scottish band Camera Obscura in 2006. One of Britain's most articulate lyricists, Morrissey, has consistently sung of Britain's wretched decline. England is mine, it owes me a living, but ask me why, and I'll spit in your eye. Under the iron bridge we kissed, and although I ended up with sore lips, it just wasn't like the old days any more. Am I still ill? Does the body rule the mind, or does the mind rule the body? I dunno, and if you must, go to work tomorrow. Well, if I were you, I wouldn't bother. The Smiths, Still Ill, 1984. Morrissey symbolically expresses modern British feelings of disgruntled confusion. Ask me why, and I'll spit in your eye. Unease with displays of human affection. Kissing only gives him pain, and sadness at the passing of the old days beneath the imposing structures of cold, rigid society, under the iron bridge, then wonders from where does this disquiet spring? The mind, personal attitude, or the body, physical reality, surroundings? His petulant lethargy, having no will to work, conveys the negativism of British youth of the 1980s, and indeed today. Lyrically despondent, British pop music has gained a positive counter-energy from different kinds of musical genres imported along with the immigrant community and is now more eclectic than ever. The Beatles, of course, based their first songs on American blues rhythms, and today's British music scene has no single simple identity but wears influences from many cultures. Bhangra, Indian dance music, ska and reggae, Jamaica, soca, Trinidad, jungle, African and Caribbean, and Eastern European folk styles have arrived on the coattails of immigrants and can all be heard in the current United Kingdom pop charts. Absorbing the new culture whilst lamenting the disappearance of the old country, British pop music is a neat metaphorical cipher for the emerging 21st century British identity of those who play and listen to it.